Many coastal communities depend on the oceans for their sustenance. And as the oceans become more and more an arena for capitalist expansion, their way of life is under constant threat of extinction. New generations of technologically advanced, hyper-efficient industrial vessels have gotten too good at fishing. This limited number of vessels has a massive impact on the ocean. Fish stocks have largely declined since the 1980s, but not all fishers contribute to the problem to the same extent, nor are all fishing livelihoods impacted to the same degree. The crisis of overfishing, fueled in large part by this small number of industrial vessels, is threatening the livelihoods of coastal communities and small-scale fisheries around the world who depend on the ocean as a source of food and income. Small-scale fishers around the world rely on traditional methods and practices, working in harmony with the environment to feed themselves and their communities. Around the world, they are rallying around the idea of food sovereignty and the vision of a global food system with food producers and human rights at its center. Here at the State of Power podcast, we're concerned with the ways in which power functions on land and on the sea. With the United Nations Oceans Conference coming up between 27 June and 1 July 2022, we thought this would be as good a time as any to take a closer look at the oceans that make up more than 70% of our planet's surface. How are coastal communities dealing with the capitalist advance into the oceans, this so-called blue economy? What are the challenges faced by small-scale fishers today? Who are these small-scale fishers, from France to Indonesia to South Africa? What social divisions exist within this category of small-scale fisheries? And what roles do class, gender, and even race play? And in this light, to what extent do small-scale fishers constitute a political subject that can fight for change? Thibaut Josse works at Association Plein Amer, a collection of fisher people and fish eaters working together for local, equitable, and sustainable fisheries through the development and strengthening of community-supported fisheries. A fisheries engineer, he works with coastal communities in France and in the Global South for social and environmental justice. What follows is his conversation with your host today, Mads Babbesgaard, who is a researcher with TNI working on struggles around the use and control of land and ocean resources in the midst of the energy transition. He's also an associate senior lecturer at the Department of Human Geography at Lund University in Sweden. Mads began by asking, what are the specific challenges facing small-scale fishers today?
Just to situate a little bit what I do, I'm working for a French organization called Plein Mer, which works mostly with French small-scale fishers. So my point of view is obviously will be situated mostly in the French context. From what I can observe, one of the big issues small-scale fishers can face today, particularly in France, but in many other parts of the world, is competition with industrial fishing. Particularly because of unfair quota repartition, allocation of quota. So this can take many ways. In the different systems that exist for allocating quotas, you have IDQs, which is basically a privatization of the fishing rights. That means that when you're a fisher, a small-scale fisher, and you want to be able to fish, you first have to buy some quota, and then you want your business to be profitable. Otherwise, you won't be able to buy the quota anymore. You will have to sell it and you will just get out of the industry. So that's the first quota system that exists. That doesn't exist in France, for example, yet. But there is many other systems that actually like are related to this one. For example, here in France, when a fisher sells his boat or her boat, it's going to be sold with the quotas on it, which means that the prices of the boat are going to increase a lot. Not because of the value of the boat, but actually because of the quotas that are on it. So whatever it is, ITQs or this kind of intermediate quota allocation system is going to lead to a concentration of the fishing rights in the hands of big actors and usually industrial fishers. That's what happens a lot in France.
particularly in the north, close to the channel, so in the region of Normandy and Hauts-de-France. And those industrials are basically going to buy a lot of little boats or middle-sized boats, and then they buy the quotas that are allocated to those boats, and they can break the boats and basically build bigger boats with all those quotas. And as they are the big actors, their businesses are really profitable, so they just don't have any difficulties buying small boats for good prices. And it's really hard for fishers today to buy boats because of this quota allocation system. And it's also really hard for them to fish when they have a boat because most of the quotas are allocated to the big industry. So this is like more in terms of how industrial fishing can threaten small-scale fishers because of the quota allocation. But obviously, industrial fishing can threaten small-scale fishers in many other ways, like, for example, overfishing and depleting the stocks. But then you also have to stay like aware that small-scale fishers themselves, in Europe in particular, can overfish, which happened a lot. And they are basically forced to it by the capitalist system, because when you are a young fisher and you want to buy a boat, it's going to cost you a lot of money. It can cost up to 1 million euros to buy a boat. And then you have to reimburse the credit to the bank. So you're basically going to take risk and go to the sea, whatever the weather is, in order to get fish and then to sell it and reimburse your credit, which encourages the cycle of overfishing and puts at risk the life of fishers. And then maybe another challenge that I see in Europe, but also in many global South countries, is like big industrial projects that are developed on the coast, on the coastal parts. Like basically wind farms in Europe are a huge issue. Like fishers are struggling a lot against it. But if you go to Indonesia, for example, you're going to have mines, industrial tourism, projects that are developed basically by the states and industrial promoters, and where local fishing communities are not consulted at all.
Thanks for that overview this distinction that you made between industrial fishers and small-scale fishers. We'll be picking up again a bit later. But before turning to that, I'd like to hear a bit more about this group that you mentioned, Plein Mer in France. If you could get a bit into, you know, as an organization and as trying to kind of mobilize and organize small-scale fishers in France, what is it that you're fighting for, and how are you going about that?
So basically, Plein Mer is a small organization that exists now for 3 years. It's been 3 years we are working, and it's an organization of small-scale fishers, but also fishing, fish consumers, and like anyone can be part of it as soon as you're into like encouraging more social and environmental justice in the fisheries sector. We fight against all the things I was talking about just earlier. So basically a fair allocation of fishing rights, less or no industrial fishing, and at least less competition with the industrial, that like less impacts of industrial fishing on small-scale fishers, blue capitalism in general, and how to make local seafood accessible to people on the coast. So how do we do that? Our main project has been working on community-supported fisheries, basically encouraging small-scale fishers to develop direct selling and giving them visibility. Because to us, we see that, so basically the system of selling fish in France is pretty in favor of the middlemen. And that's really at the expense of small-scale fishers. They go at sea, they don't know what they're going to get, if they're going to get fish. And then maybe they get some, they come back to the land, and then they have to sell their fish. And the auction is like a descending system. It like drones the prices down, which is highly problematic for fishers, because if they get low prices on the fish, they get into a volume logic. They have basically to catch huge volumes of fish to make a small amount of money. So we are trying to fight that with direct selling. Basically, the fish being sold directly from the fisher to the consumer, which is community-supported fisheries. And that is going to help fishers to be able to be supported by consumers in this capitalist system, meaning that in order to reimburse their credit, like I was talking about before, they're not going to have to take risk or to overfish. And for the consumer, it's going to give them opportunities to have access to fresh seafood caught locally with sustainable methods and at an accessible price, because it's going to be way more accessible than in a big like market, in a supermarket. And it's going to be still a better price for the fisher than in the fish auction. So everyone is winning here. So that's what we've been working on. And how do we work on that? It's basically we've been working on a digital numerical tool, which is a map that you can find on our website. When you go on a map, you just click on different points. Hundreds of points are on the map, and every point is a place where you can buy local seafood directly from the fisher. We've published a first one 2 years ago now, and we're going to publish a new version of the map at the end of June. And this is going to be more than 500 places in France where you can buy local seafood directly from the fisher. And this is going to increase in the next few months. We are planning to have way more fishers on the map because now this tool is completely interactive. Consumers will be able to propose modifications. Fishers will be able to manage their own account on the map. They will be able to send notifications to the consumers. Anyways, that's how we support community-supported fisheries. And then there is the work against allocation of fishing rights, industrial fishing, and blue capitalism in general. On that matter, French fishers have been fighting mostly for the fair allocation of bluefin tuna quotas, because those quotas have been really grabbed by the fishing industry, particularly in the Mediterranean Sea. So the fishers went on court. Basically, it's now been more than 5 years, and they won almost a year ago. So the court basically said that the state was guilty of unfair allocation of the quota, which might in the future change the whole quota allocation system in France. Obviously, the state appealed the decision, so we don't know what's going to happen yet. But fishers are definitely fighting with legal ways in order to change the system. And then we also organize events. For example, we organized a big protest in Concarneau, so in Brittany, a year and a half ago, which was against industrial fishing. There was a christening of a new super trawler, which is a huge 80-meter boat named Scombrus that can catch up to 200 ton of fish a day. So we organized a protest. We made a big campaign with the media to inform people about those fishing practices, those fishing companies. And we do that regularly. Usually it's like counter event. That works pretty well. And we've been doing that as well in Brest a few months ago. There was this French state and French president organizing a blue washing event about all the money you can make with the sea. So we, fishers, plein mer, and other organizations like Greenpeace organized collectively in order to make counter events. We also made events with the students to talk about alternatives, to talk about capitalism in the fisheries sector, all those things. And that's mostly sensitization and propaganda, but that's trying to basically mobilize people on those matters.
Thanks, Thibaut. Super interesting. Before we turn to this tension between what you call industrial versus small-scale fishers, I was maybe just wanted to get you to elaborate a bit more. So you mentioned this, one of the things you're fighting against is what you call blue capitalism. And I was wondering if you could just elaborate a bit on, what is it you mean by blue capitalism more specifically?
Mm-hmm. So it's basically now the land on Earth has been covered by capitalism, and oceans are seen as a new frontier for capitalism to develop. So basically for industrials to accumulate more profits. And what happens concretely on the ground is the state and industrials developing projects. It could be mines, it could be tourism, it could be wind farms, it could be fossil fuel energy projects, whatever you can make that can create profits from the sea resources or just from the sea landscapes, for example, in the case of tourism. And this is not only encouraged by the state, but it's also like disguised into a whole discourse called blue economy, blue growth, blue whatever, actually. And this discourse says that it's not only making profit from the ocean, but it's also about conservation, which as a NGO working for more environmental justice, we could be interested in, but it's only words. Basically, they want to do greenwashing applied to the sea and explain that all these new developments are going to be good for the environment, but they don't care at all about it. That's not the purpose of it at all. And the impact socially are also really important because local communities can be fishing communities, but can be many other coastal communities are usually not consulted. You have tools that are used like marine spatial planning, which is basically building big maps of the sea areas and choosing places where you're going to put the projects and not consulting at all local communities in terms of what they do with the sea. And then using those tools to legitimate your projects. So that's how I would quickly summarize like blue capitalism. I'm not sure if it makes sense.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. So this is especially pointing to some of those sort of broader or many of the other sectors around the, you know, what some call the ocean economy, basically, that small scale fishers are kind of struggling against that you were talking about in the beginning, right? That's what you sort of encapsulate within blue capitalism, as I heard it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks for that. I now want to then turn to a tension that you've already been flagging a couple of times in your responses until now, where you've been making this distinction between, again, what you call industrial versus small-scale fishers that you mobilize and organize in Plein Mer. So I would like to hear your reflections basically a bit on small-scale fishers today, right? And so aside from the work that you're doing at the moment in France, you've also been doing work in Indonesia and a bit in South Africa as well, right? So I would just like to hear your reflections on, you know, working across these different contexts, who are the small-scale fishers today?
Yeah. Maybe just to come back on the industrial fisher, small-scale fisher really quickly. There is no industrial fisher. There is capitalists who own boats, and then you have fish workers on it, and then you have small-scale fisher who own their own boats and fish on it. So we're not like encouraging a fight between fish workers who work in the industry and artisanal fisher. What we encourage is a common struggle with fish workers and small-scale fishers against the capitalists that are, in the meantime, exploiting the workers and destroying the environment that small-scale fishers rely on. In terms of how to define small-scale fishers, it's true that to me, after working a little bit in the Global South and a lot more in France, I would say there is not a like proper definition of small-scale fishers, and many Indonesian fishers I know would be pretty shocked on how we define small-scale fishing in France, and it would feel really industrial or maybe more like impactful to them. So yeah, I would say it's like what I've seen in Indonesia is way more small-scale than what I can see in Europe. The boats are way smaller, way more dangerous. The motors are really, really small. Fishers, most of the time, built actually their own boat, or like the building of the boat is really local in the village, which in France doesn't happen. Usually the boat is built far away. It comes from another country. It's usually way bigger. And then the gears can be actually pretty similar, but the quantity of gear that is used from small-scale fishers in France or small-scale fishers in Indonesia is really different. For example, in Indonesia, you're going to have maybe 100 of hooks in the water, and in France, a small-scale fisher is going to use 3,000. And then, obviously, you have way more small-scale fishers in Indonesia or in many coastal communities in the Global South than in France, because it's less, every little enterprise is way more intensive in terms of work and catches way less fish. So you have a little bit less fish for everyone, but you have way more fishers being able to live from the same amount of resource. Not sure if that is really clear, but that's mainly how I see it. So you can have alliances, north-south alliances, but as soon as fishers from the north are aware of the big differences between them and the coastal community of the south, for example, the fishers I know in France, most of the time they have a house, they have a car, their kids go to school, like universities. They work a lot, but their family have a pretty good life and they are way less marginalized than what I have seen in a lot of Global South communities. So capitalism is still pretty intense in terms of how it exploits small-scale fishers in Europe. But I would say the life is way more difficult for small-scale fishers in the Global South. I would say in the Global South, it's way harder to fight the difficulties. For example, when you have a project in Indonesia and you fight against the project of mining, you're putting your life at risk. In France, you're not even going to have the police saying anything to you. So there is also, like, in terms of democracy and police and state oppression, it's way different in Indonesia, for example, or in France. The risk you take struggling for your rights are way different.
Thanks for that elaboration. I think that was a useful distinction to get an idea of the differences across kind of political and economic contexts and also just scale, basically. So small scale means something different whether you're in France or Indonesia. So that's a useful distinction that we'll be picking up on towards the end. But I wanted to follow up with a further question around sort of the divisions that exist within this category of small-scale fishers, right? So now you were talking about divisions between what we could maybe call the Global North and the Global South. But I would like to hear maybe a bit more about thinking about France and, again, this category of small-scale fishers. So what type of divisions exist within that? So you clarified here already that when you say small-scale fishers in the French context, you're talking about people who own the boats and fish themselves. But could you elaborate a bit on that? I mean, do they also employ workers? Do they have workers in land? I mean, what is the role of women in the fishery system? Yeah, maybe just elaborate someone a bit on to what extent are there tensions within this category that are important to think about?
Definitely. So maybe I'm going to start with the gender question, because as I was saying, we worked a lot on community-supported fisheries. And most of the people I met working on CSF and direct selling in the fishery sector were women. Without women, we wouldn't be able to publish a map and to map out community-supported fisheries, because there wouldn't be community-supported fisheries in France without women. Most of the time, they are the one who handle the selling of the fish, the contact with the client, but also basically all the child care. Because like what happens in the fishery sector in France is that 99% of the people who go at sea are men. There is less than 1% of women going at sea. So everyone sees the sector as really masculine, which is the case when you're at sea. It's mostly men. And I would say that the conditions definitely encourage a certain kind of masculinity. But in terms of who makes this sector able to turn is definitely women. And particularly when you're talking about CSF, as I was saying, women are handling the selling of the fish, handling the communication of the company, for example, on Facebook and social media in general, but also all the child care and the care work at house is made by women, because men decide or are forced to be at sea sometimes the whole week. Sometimes they don't come back to the land in a week. Sometimes they would come back a few hours and then get back to the sea. So that's a huge amount of work that is done by women and is completely invisibilized. Like when there is public representations of fishers or even the work of many NGOs, you're going to see men everywhere with a big beard, tattoos, really like masculine image of men. To us, it's a big issue that we are trying to work on. The first step has been to get in contact with a lot of women working in the fishery sector and trying to understand their main issues. Because sometimes, for example, they are not declared officially in the fishing enterprise, which means that if, for example, the fisher and the fisherwoman divorce, then the woman has nothing. It can also mean that if there is an accident working, like cutting yourself with a knife, for example, when you are cutting the fish, then there is no insurance. The work that is not going to be done is not going to be paid. And there is a huge amount of work that is not paid and not visibilized, which is the care work. And it's not even considered as work by the fishers. So there is a lot of things to do on this. We've just started our work on gender, and we also wanted to be led by women. But for now, we've been publishing a calendar this year, which objective was to valorize all these women of the fishery sector and telling a little bit about their stories. We're going to publish a publication on gender with TNI in a few weeks, and like trying to understand this gender dynamics and see what changes could be done. There is a lot of work that has already been done by women in the sector. They've been struggling to get status, for example, the status of conjoint collaboratrice. There is many organizations, for example, ACTEA on the European level, who have been doing huge amount of work on that term, and we also want to support this in the way we can. So to answer the question, there is definitely a huge division, gender division, within the category of small-scale fisheries. And small-scale fisher can be a political subject in some struggles. For example, if you struggle against a huge industrial project or against industrial fishing, then small-scale fisher can definitely be a political subject because you're going to have the women fighting against it, the boat owners and the workers on the boat as well. But then when you start talking about gender, for example, there is a huge resistance from the men boat owners as soon as you start talking about workers' rights or women rights. And to us, that's something we really try to do, to install some kind of complexity. But it hasn't been done much. So it's sometimes hard for us to make fishers, like boat owners, understand that we can be fighting at their side against, for example, the christening of a huge super trawler, but then fighting against them to like encourage women to fight for their rights. That's what we're trying to do. And there is definitely huge contradictions to me. We were talking about the women, but for example, for the workers, fishing is a highly dangerous job in France. If you work in construction, it's usually the most dangerous work on land. And then fisheries is 14 times more dangerous than working in constructions. So there is fishers dying at sea. In winter, basically every week. And so there is definitely contradictory interest between the workers and the interest of the boat owners, because the boat owners want to reimburse their credits and might want to fish a lot. And the workers might want to have nice conditions, possibilities to see their family. Usually they make money. Usually when the enterprise is working well, the workers are paid, basically it's a share of the catch. So usually this can be pretty equitable in the small scale sector, but in terms of working conditions, it can be pretty hardcore for crew members. And it's quite hard to organize because it's not like a common organization against one owner of one big corporation. It's like a lot of workers in a lot of different little companies, and these little companies are in competition. So it's pretty hard to organize workers, and the syndicate, the trade union who were supposed to do it, have mostly been co-opted by some local interest or feudal baronies. So like, yeah, worker struggle is pretty hard. And then you have a lot of racialized workers in the fishery sectors in France as well. A lot of Senegalese migrants, for example, but also Indonesian workers being sold basically by Indonesian agencies. Because as I was saying, it's hard to be a fisher. So, I mean, a lot of young people in France don't want to be a fisher anymore. And no one is questioning the model. No fisher, no boat owner is going to say, yeah, maybe our model is really too intensive and maybe we're going to find a way to work less with less intensive technologies or whatever. It's hard to question because they would have to question capitalism. So that's not, I mean, they are also oppressed in a way by capitalism. But anyways, so their solution is usually to employ like racialized worker who would basically do a lot of work to get a living because, for example, they want to send back money to their family or whatever. So this is also creating a lot of oppressions in the fishery sector. There's been a report being published by, I don't remember which NGO, in the UK fishery sector a few weeks ago. And it's like terrible to see the amount of racism and like basically aggressions that those fishers suffer from at sea. But also like the practices of some boat owners, whether in the industrial sector, but also in the artisanal one, using some juridical visa techniques to trap the workers, the racialized worker, into a modern slavery system. And this is the kind of things you can see in Indonesia. You can see a lot in Southeast Asia, but you also have it a lot in Europe, and it's not questioned in the sector. There is no campaigns, there is not enough work that has been done about that. And also it's really hard for the workers to organize because they don't want to lose their job. So it's really hard for them to build a common struggle. Yeah.
Thanks a lot for that, Thibaut. Really fascinating to hear these different challenges and tensions that also exist within this small scale category. So thanks a lot for laying those out. And so with all of those challenges and tensions in mind, I'd now like to turn to basically hear, you know, in light of all these difficulties, right? And again, these challenges also between boat owners, laborers, but also around the gender question, the questions around race. Why is it then that small scale fishers still matter? You know, why is it worth fighting for politically, economically, environmentally, in terms of food provisioning, perhaps? Could you lay out a bit more, you know, why is it that Plein-Mer identifies this small scale fisher as a useful kind of political project?
I mean, I would say, as I was saying before, like there is the political subject of small scale fisher, but we also want to encourage the struggles within small scale fishing in terms of gender and race, whether it's, even if it threatens the current model of what is called small scale fishing. And there is many things, like we definitely fight for the survival of small scale fishing, but not the survival as it is now, the survival of a new model that would be not patriarchal and not racist, which is not the case at all today. There is not only one struggle against the bad industrial guys who overfish and get all the quotas, but there is also an inside struggle within the small scale sector of like, how do we support workers, racialized people, women, and also LGBTQ people who we haven't talked about yet to have rights in this small scale fishing sector. So sometimes definitely the question of like, why do we support this sector and the small scale fishing as a whole is definitely emerging in our discussions in Plein-Mer. In terms of food rights, we do think that in the fights for food sovereignty and access to local food, culturally appropriated, healthy, etc., there is definitely a need to conserve a sector of small scale fishing. Whether, even if this sector has to be more environmentally sustainable and way less oppressive for people in general. So Small scale fisheries do matter for local coastal communities to have access to seafood, to have access to jobs, because when you have one person working at sea, usually if you have four people working on the ground in the same fishing industry. But again, this fishing industry, like those jobs are usually exploited people working for middlemen, working for another capitalist. So you really have to be careful that you don't defend the capitalist, but the workers. But there is definitely like for local economies, like in terms of macroeconomically, like fisheries are nothing. But in terms of local coastal economies, it can be huge, can be supporting the life and the work of many people. And so it's like a double struggle between maintaining a sector and changing the sector from the inside, basically.
Fascinating to hear that. Nicely put as well. Can I just follow up with around this inside struggle? Does that also entail challenging the ownership model? I mean, so with one boat owner, are there also efforts to, you know, to try and organize, for example, worker-owned boats? Is that taking place?
Yeah, I mean that's the future. That's what we would love to encourage. We are working on a project, but it's like the real beginning of like some sort of cooperative where citizens and workers could be working together to own boats collectively. And then maybe the fisher could even get a salary from the cooperative and not be paid depending on the fish, on the amount of fish he gets. Like there is a lot of work we are starting to do on this matter, but it's really new model in terms of like the traditions of the sector. Even for the youth, it's pretty hard to like come to them and talk to them about like, for example, a worker's own boat. Like there is a lot of community organizing to do and to talk about politics with fishers before we get to a point where they struggle for that. Definitely that would be like the kind of projects we would like to develop. There is like a new project right now in Brittany of two young ex-researchers who are wanting to fish with the wind. So basically fight against the fossil fuel part of the sector, because like small scale fishing in Europe is still fishing that relies hugely on fossil fuel. So they want to struggle against that part of the sector, but also build new social models for themselves, because they're going to be the workers on their boats, and take scientists on board as well to work on sustainability, to work on conservation. So there is definitely a lot of projects happening, but it takes a lot of time. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. It takes time. And even, you know, a lot of challenges remain, right? So even if moving towards these worker-owned boats, right, that still wouldn't take them outside of these capitalist social relations that you're talking about, right? So they're still embedded within these broader competitive dynamics that Liam and Alex also spoke about with this phrase of accumulate or die. So, but super interesting to hear about this work that you're doing and thinking kind of creatively and trying to lay out new visions for this segment of the sector. I'd like to hear now then maybe a bit, because you've now been talking about alliances or trying to think about alliances sort of within the small scale segment, but you've also spoken about alliances within the sector. So with the laborers on the more kind of capital intensive form of fisheries. But to what extent are you trying to build out alliances to other sectors engaged in sort of ocean industries, right? So for example, seafarers, which we spoke a lot about with Liam and Alex. To what extent are you trying to build out alliances with other sectors, or for example, also land-based agriculture?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty difficult to build those alliances. I've been observing a little bit the work that, for example, seafarers do, and they're really well organized. Really, like, you can feel they're really lefty with a huge, like, class consciousness. And it's really, like, something we would like to see in the fisheries sector. But it's also, like, hard to make those connections, because it's really, even if it's, like, still related to the sea, the jobs are pretty different, and sometimes they don't connect because they don't live in the same places. For example, when you have small scale fish in a little harbor, you don't go to the industrial harbor where the organized seafarers are. So it's pretty hard connections, but we should definitely try harder on that and try to make those connections. The connection that's worked the best for us for now are like two connections. The environmental NGOs, as crazy as it can seem, and students. We've done a lot of work with environmental NGOs around like how to ally between ecologists, the environmental movement, and small-scale fishers against industrial fishing. And it has worked pretty well, even if it can be like really challenges because the ecologists come with their ideas, the fishers are pretty scared of it, and you have to make like translation basically between the two worlds. So it can be quite tricky, but we've done like interesting, for example, the protest in Concarneau or the protest in Brest a few months ago that I talked about. One of them was with Bloom, which is a French fisheries NGO that has done like tremendous work against electric fishing, for example, or deep sea bottom trawling, and allowing with like having the force of the fishers, the experience of the fishers, aligning with the environmental experience of those kind of NGOs can be quite powerful and quite scary for industrial actors and for the states. So in terms of like creating opportunity for change, I find it quite powerful, even if it can also be like dangerous for both sides because they also have really different interests. The fishers want less quotas and the environmentalists want more. So there is like a lot of tensions to manage. But when you're fighting a specific common enemy, it can be quite powerful. And then we've seen like students organize quite a lot around the One Ocean Summit in Brest last February. And they organized like 2 days of, 3 days even of conferences around like building radical anti-capitalist struggle to in the sea sector in general. And so fisheries were discussed and they invited Plein Mer to give a talk about fisheries. And they were really interested, really wanting to organize, wanting to meet with fishers to like get into a CSF. They like bring the radical anti-capitalist politicized side of the struggle. So it's been a really good experience. And I wish we can like keep doing that way. And then I know that NAMA, so it's North Atlantic Maritime Alliance in North America, has been great job with public hospital workers and students in terms of bringing a local seafood to collective restaurants, to collective restaurants, basically. So they've done a lot of work connecting local fishers with public hospital workers, which I find pretty amazing. So there is definitely a lot of possibilities of alliances, but there is also a lot of challenges. Fishers work a lot. Sometimes they're a little bit in their fishing zone and don't want to talk to anybody, which is where the struggle of the women is also like hugely important for the sector because they are way different and they want to connect with other people. They want to connect with other tech sectors. They are thinking a lot more about sustainability. I mean, from my experience, I don't want to essentialize either, but from what I see, like the subject of sustainability is way more present with them. And they have, to me, a huge role in terms of building and reinforcing those alliances.
Thanks for those reflections, Thibault. Super interesting to hear these different types of alliances that you're pushing forward. So maybe in closing, so this was thinking about kind of the national scale dynamics in France, right? And you've already shown or spoken about some of the difficulties and challenges, but also opportunities that exist in building alliances, right? And as I was hearing, you at least also the necessity of these types of alliances in order to push forward. And so I would just like to hear then, in closing, in thinking about also in light of your work in other places, right, in Indonesia and South Africa, what kind of opportunities and challenges do you see for kind of transnational small-scale fisher movements?
Well, I would say in terms of the possibility and the opportunity they have, I would say they have a huge role in terms of giving visibility to local struggles and also like internationalizing the struggle. Like, I think it's been huge for the French fishers who came to Delhi in 2017 for the WFFP General Assembly to see that, yes, there are small-scale fishers themselves, but there is a lot of challenges in the Global South that they don't face as fishers, and to see how they can build solidarity and how they can also take a little bit of distance with the work they do and how they do it. Like, there is many things that those North-South connections can bring to fishers. But then there is also, in terms of challenges, I would say, from like the discussion we had just now, I think a challenge would be sometimes to bring a little bit more complexity in the narrative of transnational fisher movements, because obviously you want to put everyone on the same, under the same banner. So you want to be united together. But let's not forget what we've said in this conversation about gender, for example. Like, there should be way more space dedicated to women in those spaces, I think. And I think that will bring a lot to the struggle. And then in terms of encouraging international politics, I think transnational fishers movement have done a great job in terms of like developing the small-scale fisheries guidelines, for example, and developing all those FAO frameworks to basically support the rights of small-scale fishers. Sometimes I think it's hard for the fishers on the ground, those who fish, to really see how it can bring them something. And I think that's where the struggle is, like, how do small-scale fisher leaders internationally communicate? Like, it's really hard. It's a big challenge of time. How do you do international work and then communicate with your basis and stay close enough with the basis and close enough with the international spaces? I think that's a huge challenge, and I don't have any answer to it.
You're listening to the State of Power podcast from the Transnational Institute. This was a conversation between Thibaut Joseph, who works at Association Plein Mer, a collection of fisher people and fish eaters working together for local, equitable, and sustainable fisheries, and Mads Babisgaard, who is a researcher with TNI, working on struggles around the use and control of land and ocean resources in the midst of the energy transition. This is a companion episode to our other episode called Capitalism and the Sea, which is a big picture analysis of the changing role of the sea under capitalism, with a focus especially on the sectors of logistics and capital-intensive fisheries. I highly recommend you check it out. At TNI, we've built an entire archive of research on this and other related topics, and I invite you to explore it and use it to get a better grasp of the factors that shape the world we live in. TNI's material is all free, but we would greatly appreciate your help to keep doing the work we do. One of the ways you can help out is simply to rate our podcast on whichever platform you're listening from, and please leave us a review, which will help us to get better at what we do. If you have any questions or suggestions for the podcast, you can reach us directly at podcast@tni.org. And if you'd like to find out more about how you can boost TNI's work, please click on the Support TNI tab on our website, tni.org. You can also find us on social media at Transnational Institute on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook.